This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 60. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, a podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's going on this week, Mike?
I am in full recovery mode.
Yeah, you had like minor surgery, right?
I went in, I had some spinal injections done. You know, it's funny, I've talked to other people and they're like, oh, I didn't feel a thing. And I'm just sitting there thinking to myself, yeah, but you're not immune to lidocaine, so.
Yeah. Oh, really? It doesn't work for you? It doesn't make you numb?
That's
not cool at all.
And people don't believe me when especially doctors don't believe me when I tell them that the stuff just doesn't work on me. But the last time I was at the dentist, I had 6 lidocaine shots plus 2 bone drills. And that was when I finally stopped feeling pain.
Wow. Well, I'm sorry to hear that, man. You're already on the road again, right?
Yep, okay. Just for this week and next week, though.
Okay. But at least you're able to travel and such.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I would just think getting shots in your back would kind of hinder that for a while. But
it actually didn't. Things were actually a lot worse before I had the injections. So, okay. And it's a steroid cortisone injection because some of the lower discs in my back were having fragments that are breaking off. And what happens is it gets inflamed and then they're supposed to kind of dissolve on their own, but they haven't been. And it's because the whole area is inflamed and not infected or anything, but it's just, you know, irritated. So they don't naturally dissolve on their own. And because of that, it basically creates more inflammation, which creates more swelling and everything just, you know, the cycle just kind of repeats. So it gets worse and worse. The day I had the injections, it was last Wednesday, and things were actually pretty bad. And then I took things easy for the rest of the day. And then the next day, things were a little bit better. And the day after that, it was better. And I had a 3-hour car drive a couple of days ago that was pretty rough afterwards. But other than that, I've been feeling pretty good.
Yeah, the astute listener will notice that we missed an episode last week. We didn't release, and it was because Mike had this procedure. And you took a medical leave, a medical week from the podcast. So, hey, I wanted to give folks an update about MicroConf. You and I were just talking about it before the podcast. Basically, at this point, we're honing in. We'd already talked about Tropicana and Hard Rock, and we still are looking to make up our mind. But some dates I wanted to throw out for people to mark on their calendars for potential dates are April 16th, 17th, April 30th, May 1st. And those, don't buy plane tickets yet. Obviously, it could feasibly still change and be a whole different month, but that's what we're looking at. We're very excited. We're upstaging it this year. Last year, we were at the Riviera, which is an older hotel, and we're looking to just go, you know, quite a bit more upscale per popular demand. And we already have some awesome speakers lined up, so keep your ears out. We'll be talking about that in the coming weeks. You know, today we're going to get pretty heavy into AutoShark. I got a long email from a listener and a guy we both know. Wanted to give folks an update on Hittail. You might hear it in my voice. I am pissed off right now because I spent the last 12 hours, basically until about 1 in the morning last night, and then I got up and I just worked all day today. And all I'm trying to do, it's a 6-page web application. That's what Hittail is, right? There's a marketing site that's 200-something pages, but inside, in the back end, it's about 6 or 7 UI pages, and they're very simple. They pull out of a database, and they display in a grid. And I cannot get... I have a new design for those, and all I'm trying to do is integrate the first one, into the old code, and I can't do it. Everything is broken. There are so many includes. There's like 8 or 9 different JavaScript and ASP files to make a single page work. The structure of the code is so bad that it's just a kludge. And I've looked at rewriting it, and it would take me several weeks. And so I don't know. There's no simple answer, but this is like the lowest, probably the lowest point since I bought the app, you know, what, 3.5 months ago. I just have to get through it and struggle through it. This is the last thing that's keeping me from basically relaunching the site because I need to get the new look in before I market it because it's so dated right now. I just feel like it's going to be a pretty leaky funnel. You remember the big mailing I did last time? I had mailed like 4,000 people. They were old customers that had canceled and such.
Yeah, yeah.
That turned out really well. I got somewhere around 50 or 60 new signups.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And anywhere between, there's some $10 plans and some, I think I got a couple $30 plans as well. So yeah, it's a SaaS app. So it's like recurring revenue. So it's pretty nice. It really, really helped. And then I have a recurring monthly thing now that essentially emails anyone who has canceled but is still sending us requests and that we have new keywords for. And, you know, they get an email that says, hey, we have new keyword suggestions for you. If you want to check them out, you can come sign up. So it's kind of a nice little monthly reminder for folks who've canceled. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so things are going really well on the, I mean, I'm really pleased with the new signups. And I'm pleased with the way the marketing has gone. People are pleased with the way the app's coming around. People who have used it, you know, there's a couple hundred customers now, over a couple hundred, actually. And that's really good. So it feels good in terms of, you know, it's, I feel like the app is validated and it's working again. But in terms of getting this new look in, I'm just like furious. And I'm hoping that by next podcast, I'm just done, you know, or like 80% of the way there. Because I had wanted to get this done sooner so that I can start marketing the thing. But looks like the big marketing push will definitely have to wait till after the first of the year now.
Now, are all these includes, are they all JavaScript includes?
There's a bunch of JavaScript and there's several ASP. It's classic ASP, so it is an older technology. But
Got it. I mean, you could, for the JavaScript itself, if you're having those sorts of failures, you can download Firefox and use Firebug. So that would certainly help with that, because you could step through all the JavaScript and find out where it's failing and then make sure that those things are in there.
Yep. Nah, without Firebug, I would have been sunk. I've been using that to look at the, you know, the HTTP requests. You know, the other thing that screwed me is Chrome will not allow you to set a cookie with the domain localhost, but it doesn't tell you that. So I'm trying to log in for like 2 hours and I'm like, there's something crappy in the code that's not picking up my cookie. And just over and over, I'm like, and you can't step through with ASP, right? So I'm like, response.write, where is it failing? And finally, I was just like on a whim after seriously 2 hours of screwing with it. I went and got onto Firefox and it worked and broke in a different way. And then I was like, what is going on? So I went online and sure enough, since I'm running on localhost, Chrome won't allow you to set a localhost cookie. Isn't that weird? Yeah, it just totally screws you. So little things like that. There's been like 10 things that have just been weird, tricky, Ajax-y, you know, things that are so hard to see because you're not able to step through them and see them in a debugger. And it's all kind of guesswork as to what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, that does kind of suck. I mean, I ran into not quite similar issues for AutoShark, because I had to develop locally, but I'm using SSL certificates. So that makes things a little bit challenging because everything is done over SSL. So I have to make sure that in my dev environments, I'm also using, you know, SSL as well. So I have an SSL certificate for my laptop, one for my desktop, and then I also have one for my server. Bit of a challenge.
Right. No, that makes sense. Yeah, and I've resigned. I mean, this is the downside of taking over a code base. And I know that. I knew that going into it, you know, that taking over someone else's code is always hard. And like I said, this is the low point. I'm not saying, oh, I shouldn't have done this. I have no regrets. Like, I'm very pleased with it. But I'm just at that low point where literally like 2 hours ago, I was just spouting curse words at the computer, you know, so pissed off. And questioning every hour that ticks by, I'm thinking, how I could rewrite this. It would take me several weeks, but maybe, you know, should I do that? And so there's that doubt in the back of my mind of, do I just rewrite this whole damn thing? And so I started sketching out what that might look like. I actually started writing a spec and recorded a screencast for a developer who works for me to rewrite it in ASP.NET MVC. And the more I got into it, the more I realized, although it's only 6 or 7 pages, it's quite complicated. And it seems simple when you look at it, but as you enumerate everything they're going to have to do and how they have to do it, because you can't just use basic queries, right? You can't just say select star from this, because one of the tables has 1.2 billion rows in it. So you have to have a very specific query structure. So there's just, at that point, it's like, this gets more complicated and I'm going to lose, you know, have bugs and I'm going to lose some features. And you just know how that goes when you go to rewrite something. It's always more complicated than you think it's going to be.
Mm-hmm. No, I definitely know. I mean, just to look at how long I've been working on AutoShark. I mean, my original intention was to, what was it, have it out the door and possibly
8 to 10 weeks.
I think I wrote a blog post about it a while back. It was back in July or something like that. That was when I was looking to originally push things out and start going live with it. And here it is 5 months later.
I think we want to get pretty deep into Audit Shark, and specifically some comments that I've heard both from this email I got from a friend of the podcast, Lester Buck, as well as some stuff, you know, Ted Pitts mentioned at Business of Software, and other people have mentioned, you know, offhand to both you and I think. And it seems like it might be just a good discussion to kind of dig into some specific points about Audit Shark and some points about maybe some confusion about what Audit Shark is, how you have or haven't been marketing it, have or haven't been developing it, you know, just different opinions people have, and kind of just hear your side of the story.
Sure.
Lester was at MicroConf last year. He's a Micropreneur Academy. I'm pretty sure he's a lifetime member. And mm-hmm. He sent a very long, well-written, well-thought-out email to me. He's like, I have concern about Audit Shark and Mike, and I'm concerned that, you know, he's going to release and nothing's going to happen. And I read it and I was like, this is good. And I forwarded it to you. And so, Lester, I apologize. It totally didn't occur to me because I thought it was just so well-written. But he's really given constructive things. He just is, but he tells it like he sees it.
I sent a couple of emails back and forth to Lester, and I even told him the questions he asks are really good questions. I told him flat out, I said, I don't think you should temper those questions. In fact, they should probably be a little harsher because, and not just for the questions he asked me, but in general, when you're asking questions, it makes whoever is answering them be spot on with their answers, and they have to have clearly thought through what their answers are to those things. And being prepared for those types of things makes them truly think about what it is that they're doing and whether or not they have seriously considered the ramifications of whatever path they're on.
Right.
And I told him I didn't take offense to anything he said one bit. And he asked some very good questions. So we'll definitely get into those though.
Cool. I don't think I'm a great accountability partner. I don't push things, right? I ask your opinion. You say, oh, this is what I'm working on. And then I let it go. And it seems like other people, they just tend to push more. And for some reason, that's like not in my personality. So even this email, stuff I'm going to read, is just like more forceful than what I would tend to say on the podcast. And so this is a motivation for you to think about how maybe you reshape how you talk about Audit Shark. And this is motivation for me to think about how I kind of push you in future podcasts. So first quote was from Lester. He says, frankly, I hear myself in the things Mike says in thinking that reciting technical minutiae is the same as business progress. Does Mike actually enjoy the marketing? In your book, that's my book, Start Small, Stay Small, you come right out and say that it will be 15% coding and 85% marketing, but you let Mike off the hook with 85% coding and 15% marketing progress. And then he puts in a quote, kind of a, you know, a chuckle, kind of like, but it's so good, it will sell itself. So he has a concern that you're not working enough on marketing, that really when we do our updates, I do tend to talk more about doing marketing tasks, and you tend to talk more about a technical challenge that you faced.
He's absolutely right. I talk more about the technical side of the things that I've been working on, primarily because they're the things that I'm most focused on at the time. And it's not to say that I'm not doing any marketing, because I certainly am. I mean, I'm doing link building. I'm building a mailing list. So one of the things that I haven't really talked about so far is that I've been putting together a newsletter where it's very leading to whoever subscribes to the newsletter. And the idea is to essentially teach the subscriber to the newsletter about compliance and the things that they should be looking for, the things that they should be doing. And it's not technology specific in any way, shape, or form. It doesn't even relate to Audit Shark at all. What it relates to is specifically how they should go about their job and what they should look for in the tools that they use to get that. Now, I've done compliance software before. I've actually built compliance software before, and I know what sort of things people are looking for because I've done enough compliance consulting. And the things that enterprise companies look for are basically the same things that smaller companies look for. The problem is that the enterprise companies tend to have external regulations that dictate what they need to do. The smaller guys, it's more of an honor system. They're supposed to be looking at certain things. But in general, they're supposed to look at their environment and start identifying where there are regressions to their security policies. And it makes it difficult for them because there's not necessarily established benchmarks for them to look at. And it just makes it difficult for them to know what they should be looking at. And their first question is always, what is everybody else looking at? And Audit Shark will help them with that. But I don't necessarily say, hey, Audit Shark is going to solve your problem. I say, this is what you should be looking for. And then kind of let them make those mental leaps in talking about Audit Shark.
that newsletter or the, you know, the series of articles you have is obviously, you could put it in an autoresponder, and when people give you their email, you drip it out to them over the course of a few months.
Yep.
Could you release that now? Do you need a product in order to do that?
No, I don't. And okay. What I'm waiting for that is to kind of finish out my thought process in the newsletter. So I'm out to about four or five newsletter articles right now, and I'm trying to think of how I'm going to mold it such that it comes to a logical conclusion and say, this is kind of where this newsletter ends. If you have any questions, let us know, blah, 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 et cetera. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I'm at kind of a cliff right now. So until I address that cliff, I'm not quite sure whether or not I should move forward with pushing that out.
Why are you making it end?
The newsletter is more like an introduction to compliance, and an introduction to it kind of has to end somewhere.
I guess, honestly, if I had a list and I got a few hundred subscribers, if it's going to be a decent funnel, I wouldn't stop it. I wouldn't say that's the end of this thing. Because, you know, someone may not buy within 2 months, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it may take them 6 months. You may have a 6-month sales cycle on this thing. You don't know yet.
I think you make a good point, though. Why should it end at that point? And the idea is, I guess it's kind of like anything where you've kind of pitched enough of your product or the idea behind your product and what it can do for people. And granted, in this particular newsletter, I've been focused more on the problem of compliance in general. What I'm looking at for the kind of the next set of newsletter articles is trying to weave Audit Shark into that such that it becomes more of a sales pitch. I mean, initially it's education, and education from the standpoint of I'm an expert in this particular area. These are the things that you should be looking for. And then morphing that into more of a, this is how Audit Shark can address these issues that you may have thought of. And, oh, by the way, here's a coupon code for a free trial for 60 days or whatever for being a member of this list. And then sure. Leveraging that over time to hopefully try and convert those people. And then, obviously, you have to measure how many people are 8 newsletters in who have purchased, how many people are 12 newsletters in who have purchased, and trying to figure out where is the inflection point of where people convert the most.
Right. It sounds to me, at least the feedback I've gotten, is that people want to hear more about this kind of stuff you've been doing with Audit Shark. Mm. You mentioned that you have been doing marketing with it, that you've done some link building, you're working on some SEO, and that you've written this list, episodes of a newsletter. What else? Like, do you have, I mean, I'll throw out an example. Like with Hittail, for over the past 5 months, 6 months since I started looking at it, I put up a Google Doc and I started creating a marketing plan. And all it is a bunch of bullets. Like, I'm not into big formal plans. It's a huge bulleted list. And I started with Noah Kagan's Mint.com marketing plan that he published online a year or two ago. And I morphed that towards Hittail, and it includes low touch, high touch, all these different kinds of marketing approaches, some of which, I mean, obviously I had to ditch a bunch of his because I'm not going to do similar things. It's just not, you know, doesn't translate. But then as I've been reading or listening to podcasts or blogs or books, anything over the past 6 months, I've expanded that plan. And at this point, I have 11 pages, solid, single-spaced, bulleted list. And that freaking thing is ridiculously good. Like, I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, but I get so excited when I look at it because I have this ream of, it, to me, like, interesting, potentially valuable, hopefully highly valuable marketing approaches that are catered to Hittail. And it isn't vague stuff. It includes specific tactics, and it includes specific websites that I'm going to, you know, do this on or this with. Realizing that half of them, 75% of them eventually are going to fail, but that I'm going to basically find, you know, the approaches that work really well. What do you have in place for Audit Shark now? Do you have a bulleted list? Is it all in your head? Are you just looking at like marketing through SEO and this newsletter? Is there going to be cold calling? Is it going to be like, what is your plan?
I haven't formally written down most of it. I keep most of it in my head. I will be the first to admit it's probably a terrible, terrible place to leave everything like that, because I'm sure that there's things that I'm missing. I do keep some things in Evernote, probably not nearly as much as I should. I've got some things kind of distributed between my iPad, my phone, and I should really use Evernote on all of them, and I just don't. So I could definitely do a better job in that regard. One of the things that Lester had brought up was that he doesn't hear me talking anything about, you know, customer development. Have I even shown this to people? I have done a demo. I did a demo for three people at one point, all on the same call, basically walking them through the interface, walk them through how it would work, what it does, what sort of reporting they're going to be able to get out of it. They liked it. They were impressed enough by it that they wanted to continue the discussion as I got further down the road with it. But I was at least able to get some of that initial feedback. A couple of weeks ago, I had a day off where I actually went to all four of the banks that are in my hometown and just basically walked in and started talking to them and saying, you know, I just want to talk to your IT department. Got in, talked to them and said, this is what my idea is, and tried to kind of hash out the things that I've been working through in my head in terms of what my mark plan is. But the target market that I've kind of talked about is really small business, small banks. And when I talk about compliance software being generally enterprise software, AudioShark is really not aimed at the enterprise. And by enterprise, generally, I think of 1,000 employees and up. That's not necessarily the number of employees or computers that constitutes an enterprise. Really, enterprise is just a label. I mean, if you go out to small companies like Axosoft, for example, they have an enterprise version of their product. It is aimed at 10 developer companies. 10 developers or 10 employees is really not an enterprise, but that's the label that they have placed on it. So that's the expectation that people have for their software. With my software, my target market is really companies between about 50 employees and about 250 employees.
So is that 50 nodes?
Yes.
And 250 nodes? So obviously, yes. For those who are new, AudioShark is auditing software. It installs on a server, and then it's charged per node. I think there's a little client piece that installs on each client, Mike, or no?
Nope.
You install it on one server. Okay.
You install it on one machine, and it agentlessly queries information from all the other machines.
Okay, so then if you have 50 nodes, they pay. Pricing is still $5 per node per month.
10.
50 nodes, $10. Okay,
yep.
So it'd be 50 nodes would be $500 a month that they would pay you, and obviously 250 would be $2,500 a month. So yep. These are definitely. See, this is actually an interesting thing because I've been confused in the past, and I've mentioned like, Mike, I don't think anyone's gonna find your site through SEO and buy from you. I think every sale is going to be high touch, definitely at first, and probably forever because it's just such an expensive price point. You may not be selling to enterprises, but it's an enterprise price point, in my opinion. $2,500 a month for a 250 person company is, you know, it's a decent chunk of change, $30,000 a year. Would you agree with that? Or do you think that you are going to make sales off your website? Someone's going to click an add to cart button and buy this, you know, $1,000 a month software?
I don't think I'm going to make sales off my website. What I do expect to happen, though, is I'm going to get leads from the website, and I'll
Absolutely.
Be able to follow up on those leads.
Right.
So that's really what I'm looking at from the website perspective. My anticipation is not that somebody is going to browse to my website and I'm going to get 1,000 visitors and 10 of those are going to say, oh, well, I'm just going to buy your software, and they're going to plunk down $2,500 a month. That is just ridiculous. It's not going to happen.
Right.
But what I would expect is that maybe somebody signs up for a newsletter and they give me their email address, which basically is permission to email them, at which point I can personally email them and say, hey, just wanted to let you know, if you're interested in it, I can schedule a demo of the software and walk you through how it works or talk about maybe the compliance problems that you're having and do more of some personalized one-on-one stuff. Because at a price point of $500 or $2,500 a month, it is worth my time to go after them individually. At a price
absolutely.
Point of $10 a month, it's not. It is
right.
absolutely not worth your time.
I think the question you were getting at was enterprise versus not enterprise. I mean, it's just a label. I think, you know, Lester brought up, he said when he spoke with you at MicroConf that you had said you had a friend who ran like a bank with 500 nodes mm-hmm. who may be interested in AudioShark. And then lately you've been saying, you know, that this isn't enterprise software. So you're saying that like you don't consider 500 nodes to be enterprise software, even though that's like $5,000 a month.
I think for compliance software, it's not. And the rationale behind that is that when you get into a much larger environment, and it's to step back and take a look at the industry of banks a little bit, there are about 8,000 to 8,500 banks in the United States. The average branch size is about 10. So 10 branches, you figure maybe 10 employees per branch, about 100 employees on average. Unfortunately, if you chop out like the top, I don't know, was it 10 banks or so that constitute 70% of the market? That means that the other 8,490 banks constitute the rest of them. So your average branch size drops from 10 to a substantially lower amount, maybe 3 or 4. You go to any given town here in Massachusetts, and you will see at least one local bank, if not two. Here in my hometown, we have 3. There are 3 local banks. And one of the ones that I'd went into a couple of weeks ago, I went in and I talked to him. I said, I just want to ask you some questions. They sat down with me. And I said, what are you doing to manage your environment? And how are you dealing with the compliance issues? And they said, well, we hire an outside consulting company to do that for us, which incidentally is something that I'd heard before. So that kind of goes to another point that I'll make in a second. But to drive kind of deeper into this particular prospective customer, I'll say, in discussing it with them, it seemed like I was having a hard time explaining to them what Audit Shark was and what it did. So I tried to simplify things a little bit and say, okay, well, you guys log into your machines, you have a policy, and you know, you log into the computer by typing in your username and password, and it authenticates with Active Directory. And they said, we don't use Active Directory. And I said, excuse me, how do you manage permissions and everything? Do you use Novell? And they said, no, what's Active Directory? And at that point, I realized that this was not my intended customer, because they had no idea what Active Directory even was. And one of the things that my software relies on is the existence of Active Directory. They were using it, they just didn't know it. And the reason they didn't know it was because they outsourced it to this other company. The other thing I found out from them was that they were an 18-employee company, which means they didn't even have an IT department. So they're relying on an outside consulting firm, which to me leads me to something else I'd learned from talking to other prospective customers, that the smaller banks tend to rely on these outside IT consulting firms. And there's a limited number of them, and these banks tend to work with the same ones year after year. So one of my go-to market strategies is actually going to be approaching these consulting firms and saying, hey, here's what I can do for your banking customers, and letting them kind of do the legwork a little bit, or the introductions to help me get into those accounts.
Right. So you're talking then about selling into IT consultants, IT auditors, right?
Almost kind of like I haven't worked out all the details in my head about how that would work yet, but it's, you can almost think of it at a high level like an affiliate program where...
Sure. Doesn't Symantec do that, and Norton and those guys?
They do, but they don't really offer software as a service. I mean, they have resellers. And right. In a way, this is a reseller arrangement as well. But because it's a SaaS application, it complicates things. You know, whose customer is that at the end of the day?
Microsoft does that, actually. They do SaaS in this fashion. So you may want to look at their model of how they do it, because they have partners who go and sell, and then they split revenue some, I don't think it's 50-50, but in some form or fashion.
Yeah, I've seen for Exchange Server, you can definitely buy Exchange email boxes and stuff, and there's different companies that will host it, and then Microsoft has their Office 365, I think it is, that, you know, there's resellers out there for that, I believe, as well.
Right. I like the approaches you're talking about. I like that you've talked to folks. It sounds like you're learning stuff from banks. My biggest concern as you go to sell Audit Shark is it sounds like you have a lot of different avenues that you're trying to pursue. And without doing it full time, I'm concerned you're not going to be able to do any of them to the extent that they need to be. Because, you know, I mean, you and I both know how intense, time intensive high touch sales are. Mm-hmm. And so you are going to get some leads through your website. I have no doubt that you'll rank for some terms, you'll get some leads, and you'll be following up with those guys. But if you're not doing that 9 to 5, 9 to 9, 5 days a week, and you're doing that evenings and weekends, then how are you going to even begin to do basically external prospecting with these IT auditors and develop the product? And once you get it installed, you know, at an alpha site or a beta site, you're going to be working with those guys. I mean, it just seems like you're really going to be strapped for time. And there's a lot of complexity to the, it sounds like there's complexity or just a lot of different options for the sales channels. I don't know. How do you plan to sort that out?
Yes. The answer to most of those is yes, there is a lot of complexity. And one of the things I'm doing now in talking to people is trying to figure out what is going to be the most valuable in terms of my time, what's going to be the most fruitful in terms of landing those first customers, those early people who are going to give me the feedback that I need. And it's not to say that I can't somehow morph Audit Shark a little bit so that it is less aimed at banks, or maybe uses the same back end and is something at a price point that people could afford. So I'm not removing options like that from the table. I'm definitely keeping them in mind, but I haven't come to firm conclusions on how to deal with some of those things. Because you're absolutely right about the fact that those high touch sales are going to be very time intensive. I'm going to have to do a lot of hand holding. There's right, no doubt that I'm.
You're going to have to help with installation, especially early on.
Installation is almost a joke.
No, you think it is. I mean, we think it is with .NET Invoice. It's like FTP this and run a SQL script. That's all it is. And we spend so much time supporting that because people don't know how to do it, or they do it wrong, or they have a server that's just all jacked up and doesn't have components that every other server should have, and they don't. I know you have an MSI and you have a really nice installer and all that.
What I have at this point is once you've created an account in the website, it directs you to go to a page where you download a zip file, you unzip it, you run the executable with the command line of install, and that's it.
So they have to open a command line. There you go. That's
right.
A support ticket right there.
Right.
No, I'm serious, dude. I know that sounds so simple, and I could do it, but so many people are going to screw that up. I guarantee it. So
I understand.
Or it's going to crash or whatever. You know, there's going to be support there. So, but that's neither here nor there. So yeah, you're going to have installation support. You're going to have sales. You're going to have a lot of stuff going on.
But it's not like if I needed to do the installation for somebody, I could do it via a WebEx or a GoToMeeting or something like that and literally be done in about 2 minutes. It's not really that difficult. And I've already got something to work on my list of things to do to put together a PDF that outlines exactly how to do it. And then I'm going to take that PDF and I'm also probably going to create an HTML format of it that goes on the download page that says, this is exactly how you install it, complete with screenshots. So I'm looking at ways to mitigate those types of problems. I mean, one of the things that I spent some time on that didn't need to be there kind of for my minimum product, but it dynamically creates the zip file for the user when they go to download it. And it does that so that it can insert their customer specific data into it.
Right.
So that the user doesn't have to do it, because otherwise I would have had them open up, you know, an XML file and then modify some stuff. That would have just been a nightmare.
Right. Bottom line, let's say they do get the command line, they get it installed, they're going to run it, and stuff's going to come back. They're going to have questions for you, right? Especially the first 10, 20, 30 customers you sell this into, they're going to be all over you for support, and you need to be all over them supporting them just to keep this stuff going. So super time intensive. And I guess that's the question that may be the question that's been in the back of my mind the whole time is, I mean, Lester points it out several times. He says, Mike says this isn't enterprise software, but he talks about like long sales cycles, high touch sales, higher price points, you know, having an auditor involved, maybe selling through an auditor as a partner into these banks is definitely more enterprise than not. Stuff like that. It's like, has a one-person software shop ever successfully sold mission-critical software to a bank? If the bank switches to Mike's stuff and you're hit by a bus, you know, what is his story to the customer? There are certain things that go along with enterprise software sales, things that we've just covered that AutoShark will probably have, like long sales cycles, higher price points, needing like a partner, you know, having an IT auditor that's a partner that then you sell through, you have to recruit them, give them a cut, and, you know, get into the bank. Potentially cold calling, high touch sales in general. I mean, so these all really are much more enterprise than say Hittail, right? Being a lower end, you know, price point SaaS app or .NET Invoice. Those are obviously not enterprise. And this is more, it sounding to me like it's more enterprise than not. You may not be aiming it at the Fortune 500 or Fortune 1000, but there are enterprise considerations that come with building this product. How do you plan to run an enterprise sales organization as a one-person shop?
I don't believe that it will stay one person forever. I've kind of resigned to the fact that if I wanted to really grow this out, it has to be more than me. I can't possibly do everything. And I understand that. I mean, if you look at the code base for the product, the code base alone is, I think, 65,000 lines of code right now. And that's for what I refer to as my minimum viable product for this. There's no way around it. And it sounds like a huge amount of code for what it does. But in many ways, what I've done and how I've done it is necessary for what my long-term vision is, which is not something that I've really shared with people, because that vision kind of needs to come to fruition before I can start talking too much about it. There are things that I want to be able to do that if I start talking about them, I feel like it would not only derail me, but would invite competition for things that I don't necessarily want people to go after yet. And I understand there's lots of people who say, well, you know, talking about your ideas is how you get them to become reality. It's nobody's going to steal your ideas. I understand that, but that there's other things to consider. I think you're right in your assessment that there's a lot of things to consider, and there are a lot of things that I'm just not going to be able to do or handle as a one-person shop, and I don't expect to be able to, but over time, I also expect that this product is going to grow to the point that I'm going to be able to hire people to help me out with it.
Right, but I mean, you know, there's always that point where you have more support and sales efforts, prospecting efforts and all that stuff. You have way more time than you do money. You may need 40, 50 hours a week. You're working, you know, doing consulting, and then you're doing this another 30 plus hours a week, but you're not bringing in enough money to hire someone. I mean, have you thought about that? Like, at what point you think you might bring in an employee or a contractor to help out?
Not specifically. It really, the money has to be there. I mean, I can already cut my hours, and I've already talked to the company that I do a lot of subcontracting through and told them flat out I'd like to cut my hours. And that is so that I can start working on Audit Shark on not necessarily a full-time basis, but on a more regular basis. And they're interested in potentially being a reseller for it because they've looked at it, they've seen what it can do, and they know what my capabilities are. They have an established customer base. I have no doubt that I could leverage them to start selling into some of their customers. And that would cut out probably 2/3 of the issues that you raised. You know, for example, how am I going to find time to do demos? Well, I don't need to find time to do demos. I could teach them how to do demos. I could teach them how to talk about the product. They already have the customer base. I don't need to find them. So there's a lot of those issues that basically get resolved by working with resellers and partners. The real question in my mind is how to structure the compensation, because it's a SaaS app. How do you do that? And that's not an answer I have right now.
Honestly, we could talk about this for like another hour. I have more questions, and there's even more stuff Lester talked about in the email, and I'm sure you could certainly talk about it for hours. It seems like we might want to continue addressing this in future episodes. And I think that
we could ask people to send in questions for me.
Send in questions. Yeah. I think maybe sharing that what you have in mind could potentially help mm-hmm. other folks beyond just the kind of the development of it.
Mm-hmm. No, I definitely agree. I mean, I can certainly be more than happy to share the things that I can.
I think people are listening to the podcast because they want to hear our stories. Right, you know what I'm saying? Right. They want to hear what you're doing, what you're thinking, mm-hmm. and basically, like, how are you marketing this? How are you thinking about it? Because I think that's why people yeah. tune into the show, mm-hmm. is to hear our trials and tribulations and to really hear the failures.
Right.
It's not that everything has to work. It's just people want to hear us try stuff. You know?
Right. It really seems like the way that I need to go for this is leveraging resellers to get into those accounts where, because it is high touch sales, those people who already have the relationships, that's going to be important. That's going to be key to me pushing this product out and getting people signed on with it. I'm not going to get those people driven to my website in the volumes that I need and be able to establish the trust that I need.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's going to be too time intensive and it's going to take too long to ramp up. I think that resellers are obviously good. It's intensive to do that, right? It sounds like you have some existing relationships where you won't have to cold call to find resellers, but just finding resellers and managing them. As an example, with .NET Invoice, we have resellers, and it's way more of a time sink than we've ever gotten money out of it. Obviously, resellers work for some businesses, but my experience thus far has been that it's not that good. It seems like your Audit Shark in the banking model is different, and they may be more used to that, and it may be more of a viable option. But I wouldn't underestimate the time that it'll take to get them on board and trained, and constantly reminding them to push your product, right? Because otherwise they forget, and they're not going to sell your product for you unless you're kind of telling them to do that.
Right. Yeah. And I've talked to 3 different consulting/service companies and about Audit Shark, and all 3 of them were interested in either becoming a reseller for it or talking to their customers about it and having them buy it directly. There's a bunch of different options there. It's just really a matter of me finding out what model fits, because I've given a lot of thought to how different reseller models work. And I'm not terribly happy with any of them that I found really so far. I mean, if you take a look at, for example, Microsoft's reseller model is that if they sell direct to you, you have to buy at a significantly higher price point. I mean, you're buying it the full MSRP. And the reason for that is because they don't want to undercut their resellers. If you look at other companies like Symantec, what Symantec does is they have a, you know, a two-tier distribution model where they sell to distributors and then everybody else, all their partners, buy from the distributors. And that's not really any big secret, but when you start talking to those customers or to those partners, you can go to any of those partners and you can ask for a price quote for something, and then you ask for a price quote from some quote from somebody else. And depending on, you know, what level of a partner somebody is with Symantec, or, you know, what their discounts are with their distributor, you can start playing price wars between them. And, you know, the sales reps are going to sit there and go back and forth, and then you end up with infighting between your partners who are trying to resell your product because they're trying to make margins. And I don't really like that model, just because of the fact that, let's say that you're a reseller for me and I say I'm going to sell my software to you for $6 per node, and then you turn around and resell it to, you know, whoever you want. If I make the same deal with somebody else and they're able to sell it for $6, basically the two of you, if you're competing for the same customer, you're going to be going back and forth with the price, and you're going to lower the price back and forth between each other to try and land this one customer. And all it does is devalue the product. And I don't like that whole concept, because it basically just puts a minimum price on everything. And at the end of the day, honestly, it's, you know, I'm going to get whatever it is that from the end customer, and then you're going to get some cut of it. I don't necessarily like that model. What I've been considering is something in more of a form of a rebate, where I have a little bit more control over it, where depending on, you know, the customer signs with me directly, and then I turn around and provide a rebate back, which almost fits in more with a SaaS model anyway.
All right. Sounds like there's a lot of question marks around that model.
There are.
I mean, and you've talked to resellers. Have you demoed for resellers? And it sounds like that's kind of your next gig if you're going to go that route.
Mm-hmm.
Like, next time we record the podcast, do you have anything scheduled between now and then where you're going to demo or show it to a customer or anything like that?
Not on my calendar. Last, I think it was Thursday or Friday, I had a conversation with one who was, they wanted to take another look at it. And just because they had some more questions about it. And at the time when I first demoed it to them, it really wasn't full featured at this point. As of last week sometime, I would say that I'm basically done with Audit Shark in terms of being able to install it for a customer and have them use it. There's one outstanding bug that I have to fix that I kind of introduced in the process of implementing the scheduler, that where it just doesn't save the data properly. So I need to fix that, but that shouldn't take more than maybe, you know, an hour or two of work to fix. But beyond that, the product is done. I can install it in somebody's environment and it will run, and on a scheduled basis, it will run the audits. You can go to the website, you can click a button, and you know, just by choosing a couple of drop downs, you specify the policy, the group of machines, you click audit, and it'll just execute that audit as quick as possible against those machines. And then it'll pipe all the data back out to the internet. So everything is basically working at this point. It's just a matter of tweaking some things in the UI to make things more comfortable, adding some of the documentation. I've already got a lot of documentation added into it, but having those, as you pointed out, having those conversations with those prospective resellers is probably going to be pretty important. And I don't have anything specifically in the product right now that allows somebody to sign on a customer as kind of a subcomponent of their account, so to speak.
Right. And that's probably not something you want to build at this point. You want to sell, in my opinion, you want to sell before you even start worrying about writing any of that kind of stuff. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Get some money in the pocket.
Well, the one thing I would say to anyone who's listening is that if you have questions or you want to hear more about what my plans are or thoughts are, or something doesn't make sense, or if you think I'm way out in left field on something, feel free to let us know. You can call in a question or comment to our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it in MP3 or text format to questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. A full transcript of this podcast is available at our website, startupsfortherestofus.com. If you enjoyed the podcast, please consider writing a review in iTunes by searching for Startups. You can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes or via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.